Opening narration.
The Akhatra Foundation presents the Akhatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akhatra AI.
Introduction.
Welcome back to the Akhatra Dialogue. Today, we're diving into a memoir that honestly hit a lot of people right in the heart. Michelle Zoner's Crying in H Mart.
It really did. It's a remarkable book, and that title, that opening line, even, "Ever since my mom died, I cry in H Mart," it just instantly sets the scene, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It turns this everyday place, a Korean-American grocery store, into, well, almost a sacred space for grief.
And that's what we really want to unpack today. How Zoner, who many people know as the musician Japanese Breakfast.
Right. The lead singer and songwriter.
Exactly. How she took this incredibly personal experience of loss and transformed it into something much bigger. Something that speaks volumes about identity, culture, family, and especially the power of food.
Yeah, food is so central. So our mission today is to explore how she does that. How cooking, specifically Korean food, became her way of holding on to her mother, Chungmi, and fighting against, well, against forgetting.
The chronological journey, the formative years.
Okay, so to understand the book, you really have to understand her background. Michelle Zoner was born in Seoul, South Korea, back in 1989. Her mother, Chungmi, was Korean, and her father, Joel, white American.
And they didn't stay in Seoul long, did they?
No, they moved pretty early on to Eugene, Oregon. And this move is really key.
How so?
Well, Eugene, especially back then, was predominantly white. So right from the start, she's living in this space of being, as she puts it, half and half.
Feeling like an outsider.
Constantly.
Yeah.
Never quite fitting in fully anywhere. That sense of cultural isolation really defined her early years.
And that definitely played into her relationship with her mother, Chungmi. It sounds like it was tense.
Oh, very much so. Chungmi had high expectations. She wanted Michelle to be the ideal, good Korean girl. You know, respectful, studious, embracing the culture.
But Michelle wasn't having it.
Not really. She pushed back. She found her identity in punk music, indie rock, this whole other world that felt like hers. But it was something her mother just didn't approve of at all.
So a classic mother-daughter conflict, but layered with these cultural pressures.
Yeah, exactly. And compounded by how Chungmi showed affection. It wasn't through hugs or I love yous.
It was through actions, specifically food.
Yes. Food was the primary language of love. Which brings us to that incredibly powerful anecdote about the Asian pear.
Oh, yeah. Tell us about that.
Chungmi would peel these pears for her meticulously, sometimes in one single continuous spiral. It was this quiet act of intense care, of precision.
Silent offering.
Perfectly put. It symbolized a kind of maternal devotion that words couldn't capture.
And the flip side is heartbreaking. Later, after Chungmi's gone, her dad tries to do the same thing, but it's just a mess, right? A clumsily hacked up pear.
Right. And in that moment, Michelle feels the loss so acutely. It's not just the pear. It's the lost care, the specific, irreplaceable way her mother showed love. It's all there in that mangled fruit.
The chronological journey, the rise and the struggle.
So yeah, this complex, sometimes painful dynamic.
Yeah.
And then life throws a massive curveball.
The diagnosis, that's the first major turning point, really. Michelle is 25, living her life in Philly, trying to make it as a musician.
You know, the struggling artist life.
Exactly. And then, boom, her mother is diagnosed with stage 4 squamous cell carcinoma. Everything just stops.
It changes everything in an instant.
Completely. It's what she calls the great clarifier. All the old tensions, the rebellion, her music career, it all gets put on hold. She drops everything and moves back home to Oregon.
And steps into a totally different role.
A total role reversal. She goes from being the rebellious daughter to the primary caregiver. Nurse, chef, advocate, everything.
That must have been incredibly difficult. Shedding that old identity, dealing with the stress, the fear.
Immense stress. The book doesn't romanticize it. It was harrowing. Managing chemo, medications, watching her once strong mother decline. But it also created a new kind of intimacy.
I see.
Well, those old resentments started to dissolve in the face of this shared fight. And food, again, became central. Michelle had to learn to cook the Korean dishes her mom craved, the ones gentle enough for her during chemo.
Like juk, the rice porridge.
Exactly. Things like juk or simple noodle soups like kalguksu. In preparing these dishes, she was literally nourishing her mother, keeping her alive. But she was also finally receiving that cultural knowledge, that language of care, directly from her.
Wow. So in the midst of this tragedy, there's this fragile bridge being built.
A very fragile bridge. And then comes another turning point amidst all the sadness.
Three pivotal turning points combined with chronological.
The impromptu wedding. This is turning point number two.
Right. She and her boyfriend, Peter, decide to get married quickly.
Yeah, because Michelle knew how much her mother wanted to see her married. So they rushed this small ceremony at her parents' home.
A sort of defiant joy, as she calls it.
That's the perfect phrase. It was a gift to her mother, fulfilling that wish. But it was also crucial for Michelle, cementing Peter as her rock, her emotional anchor for the loss that everyone knew was coming.
And then the inevitable happens. Yeah. Changmi passes away.
Which leads us to the third pivotal turning point, grief becoming her muse.
The loss wasn't just personal, was it? It felt bigger.
Much bigger. It was a catastrophic cultural loss, too. She lost her mother, but also her main tether to her Korean heritage. She felt adrift. But that intense, specific pain, she channeled it.
Into her music. Into Japanese Breakfast.
Directly into it. That first major album after her mother's death, Psychopomp, released in 2016, it's steeped in that grief.
How does it come through in the music itself?
Oh, it's everywhere. The lyrics deal directly with death, memory, her mother's presence or absence. Sonically, it's often kind of shimmering, dreamlike, but also incredibly raw and melancholic.
Capturing that disorienting feeling of loss.
Perfectly. It wasn't just, you know, an album about grief. It felt like she was processing it in real time, turning these incredibly private moments into something universal through her art. And ironically, that vulnerability became the key to her breakout success.
Core philosophy and values.
Okay, so that artistic transformation really sets up the core idea, the philosophy that runs through the whole memoir, doesn't it? This idea about memory.
Absolutely. Zander doesn't see memory as something fixed, like a photograph you just look at.
Yeah.
For her, it's active. It's fragile.
Like a garden you have to tend.
Exactly like that. It needs constant cultivation, constant work. Because she was terrified. Genuinely terrified of forgetting.
Forgetting the specifics.
The crucial specifics. The sound of her mother's voice, the exact taste of her kimchi, the way she peeled that pear. Losing those details felt like losing her mother all over again.
And that fear is what drives the next part of her journey.
It drives the culinary quest. After Changmi died, Michelle had this dawning horror that she hadn't paid enough attention. She rebelled against the Korean part of her life, and now the primary source was gone.
She couldn't just call her mom and ask for a recipe.
Nope, that door was closed. Which is such a specific, poignant tragedy for many children of immigrants, isn't it?
Yeah.
You push away the culture when you're young, and then you desperately want it back when it's harder to reach.
So where does she turn?
To the internet. Specifically, to Makanji, the Korean cooking YouTuber.
Oh, Mangshan, she's amazing. So many people learn from her.
Right. Mangshi became this kind of posthumous mentor, patiently teaching her step by step through videos the dishes her mother used to make.
The fact she had to learn from YouTube, not her own mother, It really highlights that cultural gap she felt growing up, that half and half feeling.
It really does. It underscores the isolation. But the act of learning, of mastering these recipes, It became incredibly meaningful.
More than just cooking.
Oh, way more. Take kimchi, for example. Learning to make it properly. Getting the fermentation right, the taste, the texture. That wasn't just a culinary win.
Well, it was like pushing back against time.
Exactly. It was a victory against the erasing tide of time, as she puts it. It was proof that her mother's legacy, her connection to that heritage, wouldn't just disappear. It was an active act of love and preservation.
Which brings us right back to H-Mart.
Back to H-Mart. That's the place where it all comes together. It's not just a store.
It's a trigger.
A powerful one. The sights, the smells, a specific brand of gochujang, the way the banchan looks, it would just unleash this wave of grief, often very publicly.
But it wasn't just painful, right? It was also a connection.
Yes. It was the one place where she felt closest to her mother's living essence, where she felt surrounded by that culture, understood in a way she wasn't elsewhere. It connected her personal loss to this much larger experience of cultural memory and identity tied up in food.
Three final takeaways. Integrating Lessons Reflection Part 6 covered implicitly.
So looking at the whole journey, what are the big takeaways here if we had to distill it down? Let's start with an emotional insight.
Okay, the emotional insight. I think it's about how we live with grief, not how we get over it. Zander shows grief isn't a phase. It changes shape. It stays with you.
It becomes part of you.
Exactly. And the strength isn't in erasing the pain, but in learning to carry it, to integrate it, and maybe even transform it into something meaningful, like her art, her writing, or even just making kimchi.
Okay, that's powerful. What about an intellectual insight? Something the book really makes you think about?
Intellectually, it challenges us to become literate in a different kind of language, the language of food and action.
What do you mean by that?
Well, especially in many immigrant families or just families where emotions aren't spoken aloud easily, food is the communication. The simple question, have you eaten? That's not just about hunger.
It means I care about you. I love you.
Precisely. The book forces you to recognize those unspoken languages of love and care that are communicated through practical acts, through nourishment.
Right. Okay. Emotional, intellectual. What about a universal insight? Something practical we can all take away?
I think the universal lesson ties into that fear of forgetting, that sense of urgency she feels. It's about preservation, but in an active sense.
Paying attention now.
Yes. Her story is kind of haunted by the regret of not paying closer attention when she had the chance. So the practical lesson is, don't wait.
Don't wait to learn the recipe or the story or understand that specific way someone shows they care.
Exactly. Cultural and family knowledge isn't just passively absorbed. You have to actively engage with it, record it, participate in it before it's too late. That's the quiet urgency running beneath everything.
Closing narration.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.